You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Well, it's Danny Bessner and Derek Davison, the American Prestige guys, paying their once every two months visit to the Non-Zero Podcast, unless it's the other way around.
Why couldn't it be the other way around? Bob Wright.
No, I feel like we're guests, actually. I feel like Bob's, Bob's the host here. Yeah. Bob's the pod master guru.
El jefe absoluto, as we say podcasting. Never. We do this every so often. It's a collaboration. And I wanted to start by giving you guys a menu of options as far as things we could talk about, because there actually is a lot going on in the realm of foreign affairs. So, Trump has been annoying Israel in several ways. It's always news when an American president annoys Israel. Some people think he might do the ultimate in annoying things, try to stop Bibi from proceeding with the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. Although, as we know, Trump has nothing against ethnic cleansing per se, so long as there's a five-star hotel at the end of it.
He's the one who broached the idea of ethnic cleansing Gaza in the first place, but yes.
Yeah, it was his idea. Maybe he's jealous. Maybe he's afraid Bibi's going to take credit for it.
And maybe, maybe.
It's like, wait a second.
Like, hold on a second, buddy.
So great. So,
I'm the crimes against humanity guy here, not you.
Option number two, Russia's been annoying Trump by not agreeing to a 30-day cessation of hostilities in Ukraine. Trump is supposedly pondering doing annoying things in return, like sanctions. Three. Let's see. India annoyed Pakistan by bombing it in response to terrorist attack in Kashmir that it says Pakistan was behind, although I haven't seen any actual evidence produced. Tensions have been wound down partly through the intervention of Marco Rubio. I mean, that would be a big story. This is in his entire career his first known anti-war activity, if true, if this happened. Finally, and I'll let you choose, Trump brought smiles to the faces of countless American children who can now get 30 dolls for Christmas because he did a kind of a tariff deal with China.
Only pay 30% higher.
30% higher, yeah. So make it 20 dolls. Make it 20 dolls. That'll definitely cut down on the doll count somewhat. But so that actually is a lot, right? There's a lot of stuff happening.
Yeah,
What should we talk about?
Derek, why don't we... I'm curious what you think about the Russia one. So I choose Russia, but I choose Derek to answer.
it's just Trump being inconstant. Like, all of these things are Trump being inconstant and reacting to the thing that's in front of his face, which we know about him, right? Like, it's always the last person to get a word in. Mm-hmm. As long as it's somebody he, you know, respects or feels like he should be listening to, it's always the thing that's right in front of his face that gets his attention. And with Russia, it's the same with Israel, right? He's on a trip to the Persian Gulf. He wants to make big deals. He's getting a plane from Qatar that he's gonna, it's basically just a massive bribe to the president of the United States, which is wonderful. But he's getting a plane from Qatar. He wants to do business deals with the Saudis and the UAE. Of course, he's, on an anti-Netanyahu kick right now. But the Russia thing, I mean, whoever's trying to manage his schedule and maybe steer him in a particular direction, if that's what's going on, it wouldn't surprise me. Setting up that meeting between him and Zelensky at the Pope's funeral, Pope Francis's funeral, was a genius move because Zelensky was the last guy to get in his ear. And Zelensky, to his credit, finally figured out how to appeal to Trump and not irritate him. And whatever came out of that encounter, Trump is now, on the position that the obstacle to a deal is Vladimir Putin and Russia. And it's everything flows from that. Now, he did cross Zelensky up a little bit this week. And it's interesting to me. Like, I'm curious how much Zelensky actually wants to pursue peace negotiations, because he is, of course, now saying very publicly that he's going to be in Turkey later this week, and he's waiting for Putin to come and meet him because this is what Putin proposed, that they have, you know, unconditioned, you know, without preconditions, that they meet in Turkey face to face and talk about a peace deal. This was his counteroffer to the ceasefire that it looked like the EU was going to try to impose by fiat over the weekend. And so Zelensky's, I think, calling his bluff, like saying, I'll be in Turkey. You can show up or not. And it's unclear whether Putin's going to show up. But, you know, Trump reacted to that session with Zelensky in the way that you expect him to react when you get in his ear and figure out a way to communicate with him, whatever that is, flatter him or whatever, you know, puff up his ego. He doesn't know, he doesn't have any core principles or any core knowledge of any of this stuff. He just reacts. So I think that that explains most of it. If he has another encounter with Putin, he'll probably flip-flop again. But you know, Putin is he did, as I said, he did kind of cross Zelensky up because there was this demand over the weekend from the EU and Ukraine for a 30-day ceasefire, and Putin reacted by offering these talks instead. And Trump immediately, after supposedly backing the ceasefire, went on, you know, Truth Social or whatever, and endorsed the negotiations, which kind of forced Zelensky, I think, into the position that he's in now of kind of saying, I'll be there, you know, with bells on, even though I'm not terribly certain that he's thrilled to be talking to Putin at this point.
Yeah. So you don't see like a whole new Trump showing up here.
I mean, it is, but it's the thing about Trump is it could be a whole new Trump tomorrow. You know, every day is a new adventure. There's new policies. There's new contradictory information. Like every day is a new thing with him. So I don't trust it to stick.
I mean, one thing he is showing broadly, I think, is some sensitivity to negative feedback. Like the walk back on the tariffs is pretty major. I mean, he can claim that he wound up with a good deal, but I think there was a much easier way to get there. And so too with all the other trading partners.
I mean, what's the deal? Yeah. The deal with China is a 90-day reduction in tariffs. And then what? What happens at the end of 90 days? He's either going to have to do another 90-day deal, or because we're not going to resolve all of America's grievances with China and vice versa in 90 days. So it's either another 90-day thing, or we just give up, or we put the sanctions, you put the tariffs back in place. Like I don't know what he got out of that except more uncertainty and more chances to just
Headlines.
Know,
see, that's
everybody.
The thing. Like, yeah, for most that's presidents, when the stock market crashes and then comes back up to where it was, that's like bad news because they're the ones who made it crash. But for Trump, that's like two headlines instead of zero. It's like you're back where you started. I'm really not kidding. Like, I think the guy above all has to be in the news. When the stock market crashes, he doesn't want that to endure. That is one of the kinds of negative feedback he's sensitive to. Still, it's all good in the end. If you know, it shows how powerful he was. He can just turn a knob and crash the stock market. And then in the end, he saves the day. So I think he's probably happy with that one. And the Yemen thing, which was the intervention, which everyone noted was doomed from the beginning because the Houthis famously never surrender. And by the way, did you see the New York Times piece about that?
I mean, this is what I was going to ask you. It's incredible. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
This is one of the things that annoys Bibi is that he resolved things with the Houthis without getting them to commit to stop attacks on Israel or Israeli ships. In fact, they vowed to continue, and Trump still said, whatever, we've got to deal with you. I'm quoting from the New York Times piece. So the Houthis shot down several American MQ-9 Reaper drones and continued to fire at naval ships in the Red Sea, including an American aircraft carrier. And the U.S. strikes burned through weapons and munitions at a rate of about $1 billion in the first month alone. And I guess it lasted 7 weeks. It did not help that two $67 million FA-18 Super Hornets from America's flagship aircraft carrier accidentally tumbled off the carrier into the sea in different ways, actually, as it happens. But so, yeah, it was a disaster. But I think he thinks he got out of it looking for practical purposes pretty good. Although I don't think they were actually a problem. The Houthis were not a problem for America before. And the shipping has not resumed in the Red Sea, and it's not going to resume. And that was the big issue.
All they did was agree to stop doing things that they wouldn't have been doing in the first place if the United States hadn't started bombing them.
Right.
It's extraordinary. But that Times piece was fascinating. Not only the burning through all this stuff, and you got planes falling off of aircraft carriers, and they supposedly the Houthis almost shot down an F-35. I mean, these guys are using like generations old air defense missiles, and this is the most advanced plane that the United States has, and they're almost shooting those down, and they decided that the risk of casualties was greater than they thought. But the other thing that was incredible in that piece is they asked apparently the Pentagon to produce metrics showing the success of the operation, and the only metric they got was here's how many bombs we've dropped on Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what?
That's Vietnam era stuff.
Jesus Christ.
And yet
used
they
to be like the Vietnam metrics.
They can still hit Israel's airport. It kind of makes you wonder how effective this has been.
No, good.
It's unbelievable. I mean, the whole thing is kind of unbelievable. And you wonder what will happen with Gaza. I mean, obviously, of course, the easy way to actually solve the problem that the Houthis pose, which is resume safe shipping in the Red Sea, would be to get Israel to actually do a deal on Gaza and end the war, which I think it's within Trump's power to do. But
I think this is entirely possible, is that at some point during this trip, maybe when he's in Qatar, later this week, he's just going to announce a ceasefire. He's going to say, this is what the deal is, and the Israelis can take it or leave it. If they leave it, then we're going to have problems. And that would force Netanyahu to make a decision about, you know, how much do I value my relationship with this guy? If he does that, I think it's entirely possible. If he's already considering it before he gets in a room with these Gulf monarchs who don't really give a shit about Palestine, but want this to go away in a major way. And they're the ones who are talking to him for the next several days. Like, it's entirely possible he will end this week just putting out a ceasefire and saying, here it is.
Hmm. That would be amazing. And do you think he would use the ultimate lever, be willing to actually cut off arms?
I think he'd threaten it. I think he would certainly.
There's a chance.
You
know, more
you'll
than
get
Biden,
one of these
I mean,
oblique
like,
things. Yeah. Like, you know, we do a lot for Israel. And, you know, if they want us to keep doing a lot for them, we do
and,
so
you
much.
Know, and do you think, I mean, there is a little bit of a new vibe right now. Now you can say it's just that Arabs are the next group he's going to meet. And they've already promised him a Boeing 747. But there's also the fact that
amazing.
I think
I'm not sure
I
if you want a Boeing these days, though, to be honest.
Well, it's a Qatari Boeing, though.
I would take it. I was in Doha once and I was
perfectly
nice to everybody, but they did not offer me a 747 when I left. I don't know what their criterion is.
I lived there for a year and a half.
Did you in Doha?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh man, when I was there,
I was working
like,
for the RAND,
the Doha Files
Corporation,
by Derek
Davison. Danny knows. We were reforming
you
their
were
school
a RAND
system.
Guy?
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, Derek was a RAND guy.
Research
yes.
assistant.
Uh-huh.
Derek
right
didn't sell
doing
out.
Game theory.
He bought in.
No, I was like, my job, once I like got over there, like I started out in the Pittsburgh office of RAND, but once I got over to Qatar, my job was basically to just be in Qatar. Like, they needed staff on the ground. They didn't really have anything beyond that. But yeah, that was basically it.
That's cool. When was that?
2003-ish. So about 20 years ago.
Nice. Love the war on terror. Well, height of the war on terror.
22 years ago, I guess. It was right around the time that the Iraq war started. Because I remember thinking, like, are we going to be able to stay here much longer once this thing gets kicked off? But we did. It was okay. I survived.
So what I was going to ask is, do you think part
you're
of it
veteran,
is it,
Derek?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
So do you think Trump has reconciled himself to the fact that he's really not supposed to run for another term according to the Constitution and feels liberated, like he doesn't care about donors And
seems that way, kind of. I mean, it's difficult to know. I mean, with the tariffs thing more than anything.
You know, this is Thursday or this is, you know, Tuesday. Who knows what Wednesday is going to bring, right? I mean, that's the
But he's
the
not going to see Bibi on this trip.
No,
that's significant in its own right.
Israelis, yeah.
And so, yeah, we'll see. So what does that leave? Well, India, Pakistan. I mean, now you know this area, Derek, better than I do. And Danny, you may know it better than I do. I don't know. But I, you know, one thing that annoys me about these things is that India doesn't provide any actual evidence that Pakistan was behind a terrorist attack. And that doesn't get reported. It seems to me it should be like a ritual that if in standard newspaper reporting, that if a country attacks another country because they say the country did X, the newspaper should say they have not yet provided any evidence that they did X. Now, it may well be that Pakistan's behind this, but I will say there are some unusual things about it. You know, I had Anatole Levin on the podcast of the Quincy Institute, and he wrote a book about Pakistan once. He knows the territory, and he pointed out, I mean, he's not saying Pakistan wasn't behind it, but he pointed out it was a ragtag kind of attack, like three guys with Kalashnikovs or something. And one thing I've learned since, by the way, is that the past attacks that were more confidently attributed to Pakistan hit hard targets, military, police. This was just three guys shooting up tourists. Doesn't suggest that you had a whole lot of state capacity at your disposal. And as Anatole pointed out, there are Islamist extremist groups in Pakistan in whose interest it is to start a war between Pakistan and India. And so, I don't know. I just wish people would underscore a little more the fact that India launched a major attack on a country without even bothering to assert, I think, that they had evidence. I don't know. They certainly didn't show us any, right?
No, I think, I mean, the thing with this, the group that claimed responsibility is an offshoot of Lashkar-e-Taiba, or the Indians regarded as basically a front, like a cutout for Lashkar-e-Taiba. Which we do know has ties to the Pakistani intelligence and military apparatus. But as you say, that doesn't mean that Pakistan was directly involved in this attack. What the Indians were claiming seems to just rely on the innuendo of like, well, look, it's this group. We know they have ties to Pakistan. Do the math. We're going to just accuse Pakistan of being involved in this. And it's, you know, you get the sense, or at least my sense is that this is Narendra Modi appealing to his base in the face of what was a major terrorist attack. It wasn't sophisticated, as you say. It didn't have a lot of like moving parts. It doesn't seem to have required a lot of state capacity, but it killed a lot of civilians, especially for Kashmir. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen that level of civilian death in an attack like that in many years. So, you know, feeling like he had to say something and couldn't just attribute it to, you know, this little offshoot of a terrorist group or whatever it is. You know, I think he went for appealing to the base and blaming Pakistan and going full bore under the assumption that they could get away with another, you know, exchange of fire without things going, totally out of control.
And they managed it. I mean, there may have been communication with Pakistan from the beginning. Who knows? I don't know how much credit Marco Rubio deserves. Apparently, J.D. Vance kind of said, who cares? It's not our fight. But like when the two sides have nuclear weapons, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and that's always the nuclear. I've said this on our podcast a few times, but whenever they model nuclear war, it's always India-Pakistan. It's always an India-Pakistan exchange. That's like by far the most likely place for there to be a nuclear exchange. So, I mean, I think it's always important just for that matter.
And it's always the one that they assume can be contained, right? The assumption with like a U.S.-China exchange or a U.S.-Russia exchange is that it would be very difficult to stop that short of World War III, but that India-Pakistan could somehow be contained, which is a funny thing when you talk about, you know, something that could result in the deaths of hundreds of millions of people and, you know, ruin water supplies for half the world's
and global
population,
famine
whatever it
is the big
right.
one. Right. It's the one I remember is an exchange of 100 Hiroshima level bombs. Its likelihood to result in a global famine, which would have obviously devastating consequences for an incredible number of people, like a high percentage of humanity. I forget the exact percentage, but yeah, it's no good. No good.
So is Trump, I haven't looked at his approval ratings lately. I assume they're getting a little better. Because he has, like I said, he is showing signs of sensitivity feedback. He seems to have pushed Elon Musk out of the spotlight, correctly apprehending that Musk was not a big public relations asset.
Well, I also think that was because people in the administration didn't like Musk. I mean, there were so many leaks about how unfunny he was and how awkward he was and how people just hated being around him.
I think Musk
just like got a taste of what it's like when not everyone has to suck up to you and there are people who like actively want to take down your power. And I think that my guess it would be less, my read on it is less public and more internal, is that people just hated him. And so that's why he pushed him basically out. But I thought he was co-president, Bob. So annoying. There's so much analysis. Like, sorry, I'm just going to go on a little rant. It's so frustrating how after Trump won, people are making the exact same mistake in Trump 2, which is every little thing that happens is then basically imagined to be institutionalized and a permanent feature of the Trump administration. And it's just not the case. I don't think Musk was ever co-president. And it was very clear that this relationship wasn't going to last a very long time. And it's just like, American history, I'm writing about this a bit now, it's just like every day is sort of like pastless, historyless. And I think that's very much reflected in the analysis of Trump. It's just like so frustrating at this point, a decade after this guy came down that escalator, people are still making the same mistakes of analysis, which is you have to give it some time, even with the tariffs. You know, how long did it take for him to walk back the majority of the tariffs, even though obviously... Yeah. The China tariffs are serious, but I mean, it's just like the same mistakes over and over by the media apparatus. It's just like Americans exist in this state of heightened existential angst, and it's just they're the safest people on earth. It's just very frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, it's just kind of a bias, a human cognitive bias and a media bias to like seize on to whatever has happened and see more in the way of a trend in it than there is. But with Trump, it's an especially big problem because, as you said at the beginning, Derek, what he's going to do on any given day depends on, you know, a number of semi-random factors, including who he talked to last. So he is the least, you know, if you're going to extrapolate from someone's behavior, pick any American before you pick Trump.
It's the problem with having somebody like this as the president of the United States, where you're trained for good reason. I mean, in the media, but also just, you know, citizens to pay attention to everything this person says, because it all has weight. It's the president of the United States. You know, you have to give that credence. And yet you've got a guy who just talks all the time and says things that he doesn't necessarily mean or that he'll change 30 minutes from now. And it's exhausting to cover. And I agree, you know, we should be better at it probably at this point than we were in his first term, but it's hard to retrain yourself to not react, because again, like it all should matter. It just doesn't with this guy in a way that isn't, you know, is unique, I think, for
it's
for
not normal for sure. Yeah,
right.
It's not typical, at least. Yeah.
And I don't think it's a mistake to be concerned about his various flirtations with amassing and exercising power beyond a level that is contemplated in the Constitution or in statute. You know, I mean, the many things he's done.
What's your take on January 6th? I think like that's a very good Rorschach test for how one like understands Trump. Do you think this was like a full-on coup d'etat attempt? I mean, what's your understanding of it?
I personally thought, I mean, as a legal matter, whatever the charge would have been, inciting a riot or something, it's very hard to meet the bar for that. I don't think he met the bar for that. But if you want to ask, like, yeah, did he try to subvert the Constitution? I think absolutely. And I think the key moment, like if you were going to successfully impeach him, the moment I would focus on is like, first of all, remember what was underway. Okay. It was the almost the most important ritual in American democracy, right? It was the certification of the duly elected president of the United States. And when there was a point when he knew, because he was watching TV, the crowd was inside the Capitol. He knew his own vice president, Mike Pence, was inside the Capitol. And he tweeted something at that moment, very incendiary, about Pence. I don't think he quite called him a traitor, but there were already people saying, let's find Mike Pence and hang him, you know? And Trump knew what the vibe was. He knew the crowd was out of control. He knew they were in the Capitol. And he tweeted this plainly incendiary thing about Pence, literally increasing the chances that he would die that day. So that was a full-on attempt to subvert the Constitution. Now, I don't mean it was premeditated necessarily. I have no idea what he thought would happen or was hoping would happen when he first told the crowd to march over to the Capitol. But there were a lot of people preparing the ground for something explosive. I was listening to Steve Bannon's podcast in the days before that, and I still remember, like, the night before, maybe two nights before, I remember where I was when I was, like, taking my walk. I was listening to the Bannon podcast, and I thought, you know, they better have, like, a fucking battalion around Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. This mm-hmm. is going to be very problematic. And I still don't totally understand why they weren't better prepared. But, I mean, I kind of do. You know, there had been a whole thing about authoritarian shows of force, that Trump, you know, they had been controversial and blah, blah, blah. So I kind of get it. But in any event, no, I think, I don't know if it was premeditated, but I think there's no doubt that once a crowd breached the barriers, Trump was delighted. I don't think there's any doubt, A, and B,
very clear,
he did
yeah.
at least very this one thing delighted. To yeah. encourage the further disruption inside the Capitol. So, yeah, I mean, as so far as impeachment goes, I think that's totally sufficient.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's for what sure. I would have cited if I had been Twitter and banned him and wanted to ban him. I mean, if you read their thing, it was so, I mean, don't get me started on Jack Dorsey, but it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I don't know why. Are you a Jan 6th denier?
No, I just think it embodies.
I'm a truther.
It embodies
man.
The contradictions everywhere. Of Trump. Yeah, for sure. I believe everything. I mean, it embodies the contradictions of Trump, where on one hand, it's scary and violent and absolutely outside of normal politics, but it's also disorganized and symbolic and doesn't work. Right. And so this is the contradiction of Trump himself. And so to me, that's the ultimate takeaway of that. And apart from questions of impeachment, which I'm not a lawyer, I mean, clearly it seems that might be grounds. But again, I don't really know. But, you know, it doesn't equate to me as like this. I don't think the government was on the verge of being overthrown. I don't even think that.
Well, no, there was no well-planned coup.
Right. And so it embodies what Trump is, right? Scary, weird, but disorganized and symbolic. It doesn't work.
I do think he was hoping until the last minute that somebody would save the day. I mean, people were lobbying Mike Pence until like the last minute on behalf of Trump to do something that they thought would be pivotal and refused to play his ordained role in actually certifying the election.
Right. And then, I mean, the real thing is I wish we had a better sense of what the military was thinking. Because I mean that would have been that's the hinge point, right? Regardless of what Pence does or doesn't do,
I don't
regardless
think it would have been a big problem then. But this time around, we got a different situation. He's replaced all the generals. He's replaced all the JAG officers.
Well, Bob, as you know, it's the colonels you have to worry about, not the generals who have no connection to the people, right?
Like
every coup is the colonel, Colonel Gaddafi. It's not the generals you need to worry about.
You give them enough time and they have played a role in putting the colonels where they are. My father was a colonel. And so the more time they have, if the generals, I'm not saying there's, you know, a plot afoot, but if a lot of these generals, and originally it was just kind of the top general in three of the four service branches, plus the chairman, joint chiefs of staff, JAG officer. But lately, I don't know where this stands, but didn't Hegseth just recently say he's going to fire like 100 generals or something? Well, I don't think they'll be randomly selected. And so, and my point is, you give generals, it doesn't take that much time for them to start putting colonels, and they made up, I doubt they're colonels they planned a coup with, but if Trump has preserved these MAGA generals and they choose MAGA colonels and put them in these places, I personally wouldn't feel too reassured about the situation. Now,
yeah,
it would
it's
take,
certainly not great.
It
yeah.
would take, you know, it would take a crisis. But
Bob, I have a question. How do we then distinguish between the realm of like now we're in Rachel Maddow liberal fantasia land, right? Because on one hand, there is, and this is, I think, the problem of the Trump administration. On one hand, I think you're right. Obviously, you don't want a bunch of MAGA generals and MAGA colonels and, you know, whatever 83-year-old Trump or however old he's going to be is trying to stay in office like a Hindenburg. But then, like, it very quickly gets off into, like, now we're in fantasy land where, like, we're sort of gaming out coup scenarios. And so, like, how does one protect against that by, like, taking it seriously without going too far? And I think that's it's an analytical problem because it's very easy to sort of roll down the hill.
I have the answer to that
question. Ascribe to American prestige? Yeah, I agree.
Actually, you laugh, but that's exactly right. If you want to hear the answer, you're going to have to become a paid subscriber either to American Prestige or to the Non-Zero News. I'm sorry, this is hardball. Look. That, you know, the Republic is at stake, and so good citizens like me need to have resources at their disposal, right? No, actually, you know why it's absolutely. Serious?
Do you think the Republic is at stake? Do you think that? The Republic. The
They're not
going
to get the
order.
Answer to this question for
again.
Free.
No, yeah,
now we go. Now
we
we're behind
answer.
The paywall.
Okay. So now we're heading into overtime. We hope people will become paid subscribers to one or the other, both.